Welcome to Cross-Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax updates to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. The Pillar 2 engine from PwC is a game changer for Pillar 2 modeling, provision, and compliance calculations. Built on a graph system utilizing over 20 years of international tax technology, this centralized rules engine is built by a team of Pillar 2 tax experts from around the globe. PwC's Pillar 2 engine is currently available as a service and will be licensable in July 2024. On this week's episode of Cross-Border Tax Talks, we're at PwC's Tax Leadership Conference in Orlando, Florida, where I'm thrilled to have Pat Brown back on the podcast. Pat is the co-leader of PwC's Washington National Tax Services and, frankly, doesn't need really any introduction for the Cross-Border Tax Talks. Pat, welcome back.
Doug, it is great to be back with you.
I feel like it's been ages since we've had a conversation, and I look forward to each of them.
Absolutely.
But I want to start with a question before we dive into U.S. tax, and there's plenty of stuff to cover, but with a question that has nothing to do with tax, but focuses on personal well-being. And this was a big focus of mine on my YouTube vlog from years ago.
Right.
And you and I do a lot of early morning calls, or quite a few of early, and for the particularly early morning calls, Pat, I notice sometimes you're in your gym clothes, and you keep yourself in very good shape. I don't mean to embarrass you here, but can you tell me a little bit about your personal fitness routine? And I'll remind, I'm guessing you're not doing 500 push-ups a day like Richard McGinnis, our former colleague, but any tips and what do you do to keep yourself fit?
Yeah, so I was chastised recently by my daughter, who's now an adult, who said to me that I eat too healthy and I exercise too much, which she regarded as a failing. The truth is, Doug,
you eat well and you exercise.
Where did this come from? So, the level of discipline I've applied to kind of daily exercise. I exercise every day. I run. I go and lift weights. So I alternate days essentially on that, and then one day out of seven, I'll do some other form of exercise, whatever it might be. But I 3 days a week run, 3 days a week lift weights. And actually, I am currently now in the process of training myself to run a marathon, which I've never done before.
Wow.
And I suspect will never do again because the training is not fun. And I don't really, I don't enjoy running. I do it because it's, sort of good for you. This all started, though, when I was working for the Treasury Department years ago, and I was traveling overseas a lot and was very jet-lagged, and I found that really had a hard time sleeping. And I think my wife suggested to me, you might really just, even though it's hard to do, force yourself to exercise every day when you're traveling. Even though it probably didn't help my sleep a lot, it kind of calmed me down, helped my sort of sense of well-being. So I sort of stuck with it for that reason as much as anything else. I still travel a lot, and I find it very helpful, particularly because I'm often between time zones. It's a sort of good discipline to have. You set your alarm clock to get up in the morning at whatever the right local time is and exercise. But it can be a challenge with some of our early morning calls, to be sure. I maybe indulge, particularly when I'm just talking with other folks within PwC, not to always clean myself up before that early morning call, but I will try and get the exercise in beforehand.
Well, it's inspiring. I'm not a 7 day a week. I try to do it several times a week, but I'm with you on particularly with the amount of international travel that I'm doing. I always exercise the day of, and I try to do it when I get there.
Absolutely.
Too, because it helps me fall asleep on the plane.
Absolutely.
And helps me get, it's
yep.
a great travel
yep.
hack for those going through time zones.
I agree.
All right. Well, let's get to the tax stuff and we can leave the fitness stuff to our colleague, Lily Kazemi. So it's been a while since we've done a podcast focused on U.S. tax updates. And there's been a number of developments during 2023 and some big open issues as we head into the end of the year. We can start with the details of a potential year-end tax bill that remains to be negotiated. There's been a lot of discussion on that. So what are some of the big issues, Pat, at play for both U.S.-based as well as foreign-parented groups that invest in the U.S.?
Yeah, so I think there are sort of three main issues that people are focused on from a tax perspective. I would say the biggest by far and the one that has gotten the most traction on Capitol Hill, at least overt traction, is the treatment of Section 174 expenses. So these are Section 174 research expenses, which up until the enactment of the TCJA, these were, of course, currently deductible. The TCJA provided, this was, of course, the Trump Tax Act, the 2017 Trump Tax Reform Bill, provided that starting in 2022, for calendar year taxpayers starting January 1st, 2022, instead of currently deducting those expenses, you would have to capitalize and amortize those expenses over either a 5-year or a 15-year period. And that, of course, although it doesn't have an immediate ETR or book impact for most companies because it's essentially just a current deferred timing item, as a matter of cash tax and cash flow planning, it's a significant item for a number of companies. So a number of companies are extremely interested in getting back to prior law, which is the deductibility of these expenditures on a current basis. Broad bipartisan support for this. No question that there is strong support for this. It's actually hard to find anyone to say anything negative about this, about reverting to prior law. The challenge is you need to get a tax bill together. And that has proven to be an unmeetable challenge for the Congress, at least up to this point. And so that is the biggest issue, I think, that people, the corporate taxpayer community is really, really hungry for, you know, guidance being a return to prior law. If there is a tax bill this year, I do believe it's quite certain that will be in it. The big question is, will there be a tax bill? And we just don't know the answer to that question. But 174, far and away the biggest issue. I'd say the second most significant issue in terms of understanding of the issue and sort of sympathy for the issue on Capitol Hill is accelerated depreciation or expensing. Again, this was something that was put in place in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the TCJA, on a temporary basis. It is hard to find an economist, left, right, center economist, who doesn't think expensing treatment is a good idea. Basically, the entire economics community says this is a great idea. It encourages the investment in new capital. We should be doing this. Members of Congress support it, right? It sort of makes intuitive sense to them. You build a factory, you get to immediately expense the cost of that factory, et cetera. Again, you need a tax bill to get tax provisions done. None of these things are big enough to move separately as sort of a standalone piece of legislation. Congress just doesn't have the ability to do things like that. So this will have to get rolled into a bigger package of things that would potentially get done. But a lot of support for that. The third of the three, which is the one that is, I think, hardest to explain to members of Congress, is the treatment of interest expense under 163J. So, of course, we had a limitation, 30% of EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, which starting in 2022, again, as a result of the enactment of the TCJA, we dropped the DA from that computation, which puts for a number of particularly capital-intensive companies a lot greater restriction on the deductibility of current deductibility of interest expense. Now, again, this is one of those things that can be just a current deferred split, so it may be something that you take in future years. But nevertheless, it's a significant item for a lot of companies. Why is it harder to explain? Because when you talk to people about deductibility of interest, it just doesn't roll off the tongue as easily as I'm doing research in the United States. So you have to go through a little bit more detailed explanation of, I need to borrow money to make this investment, and you want me to make this investment, and restricting my ability to deduct the interest expense on this investment makes it harder for me to make the investment. I don't think there's any real prospect for 163J falling off. It just doesn't get talked about as much. And that, I would say, for people who are continuing in dialogue with members of Congress and their staffs on Capitol Hill, don't forget 163J, because it's important for members of Congress to hear what their constituents care about so that they know they need to act on it, right? And again, I don't think there's any realistic chance that 163J falls off of a tax package if one comes together. But I would also say, just make sure people keep hearing about it, because right. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, the business interest deduction limitation is also exacerbated, of course, because of the high interest rate environment. Too.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Probably less of an issue 3 years ago than it is currently, no question.
So, yeah. Pat, can you explain to the listeners if these just make from a policy, particularly R&D expensing and the bonus depreciation, where the U.S. is trying to encourage this type of investment, why was that not permanent when they introduced the TCJA? Because I get this question from a lot of non-U.S. folks, and they're just like, this just seems like it's bananas, which is hard to argue, but there is a reason.
Yes. So it's bananas because our system is bananas, because the TCJA was passed under a process called reconciliation. Reconciliation, of course, was what was used for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It was also used, so it was used by the Republicans for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, by the Democrats for the Inflation Reduction Act. It allows you to move legislation through the Senate with a bare majority. So only takes 51 votes. And in the case of the Inflation Reduction Act, it was exactly 50 votes plus Vice President Harris breaking the tie. And so you're allowed to move legislation without having to get clear a 60 vote hurdle in the Senate. That's, of course, been a very big deal in recent years past because the Senate has been so closely divided. The challenge with using reconciliation is it brings with it a lot of procedural hurdles. And one of the challenges, one of the procedural hurdles, is a reconciliation bill is not allowed to increase the deficit outside of the budget window, which means when you put together a reconciliation bill, you have to carefully construct it so that it does not lose money essentially indefinitely. And so what the Republicans decided to do in 2017 was build in some of these sunsetting provisions, like moving 163J from EBITDA to EBIT, forcing the capitalization of Section 174 expenditures, essentially on the theory that Congress would come back and revisit these issues before those provisions ever took effect, because the theory of the case potentially was, and I obviously haven't spoken to any members about this specifically, mm-hmm. but the theory of the case appeared to be everyone will understand how important it is to have the current deduction of research expenses, et cetera. So we're just essentially kicking the can down the road, a time-honored tradition, to be sure, of mm-hmm. the United States Congress. Let's kick the can down the road and deal with this in a few years' time, where we will all be able to agree that the right answer is to continue allowing current deduction of these expenses. Well, a few years down the road came. They couldn't get legislation together to get this issue done. You know, candidly, this is one of those things, even though there's bipartisan support, the Democrats look at this and essentially say, well, this wasn't our problem. We didn't create this issue. You guys, the Republicans, did this reconciliation bill and created this issue back in 2017. So if we're going to fix it, we're happy to fix it. But we the Democrats need to get something too, even though we support this. So that, you know, there's this back and forth that happens within Washington. So, well, if I'm going to give you, the Republicans, the Section 174 thing, even though I support it, you have to give me something. And that's why, to the extent you follow these issues in the press, you will see a lot of reporting on, can Chairman Smith, the Republican chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and Chairman Wyden, the Democratic chairman of the Finance Committee, come to an agreement on the child tax credit? Well, what does that have to do with 174? Well, what it has to do with 174 is that the Democratic ask essentially is provide an enhancement of the child tax credit in order for us, the Democrats, to agree that you, the Republicans, get what you want, Section 174, Section 163J. So, look, I think there's a deal to be gotten there. I think Chairman Smith has said there's a deal to get. Chairman Wyden has said there's a deal that can be reached there. So I don't think that's going to be an obstacle. But ultimately, that's the issue that has to happen. So anyway, long answer to a short question.
It's important.
Right. It's important. And why do we have these sunsets built in? Because of this, you know, finicky procedure that we have called reconciliation.
Right. And if either party had 60 votes in the Senate, you wouldn't have to go through that reconciliation.
Correct.
But just over the however many number of years that
right.
has been an impossible majority for either party to get. So most
yes.
of these tax bills come through reconciliation. Maybe the last thing before we leave this topic, and I think this is really important for listeners, is that in addition to the R&E expenses, the bonus depreciation and interest, starting in 2025, there are some really big
yes.
adjustments,
yes.
particularly from an international tax perspective, that will come through as a result of this need to be able to effectively get through reconciliation. And that includes changes to the GILTI rate, changes to the FDII, changes to the BEAT rate.
Right.
And so I think it's really important for both inbound companies as well as outbound companies to keep an eye on that, because the international
yeah.
tax system is going to shift. And then
yeah.
it really begs the question of, well, in 2025 or 2026, do we see kind of international tax reform? I'd call it 3.0.
Yeah.
And does the U.S. Look at Pillar 2,
right.
or what could that look like?
These are all great questions. And the only thing I will add is just a postscript to that whole point is members of Congress will be spending 90% of their intellectual capacity thinking about none of the issues that we just talked about.
Right.
They will be thinking about rather the individual tax cuts that also came in 2017 in the TCJA, which sunset at that same time period. And so for the members of Congress, the question is going to be, what are we going to do about the individual stuff? And frankly, with whatever is left over of their capacity to consider these issues, what do we think about these, frankly, quite significant changes potentially on the horizon for international tax. So I think some of what companies are going to have to do is make sure they get in front of members of Congress sooner rather than later to say, you know, this is really important stuff, and we need to make sure as you're thinking about these individual things, you don't forget about the international tax changes that will take place unless Congress actually acts.
And 2025 sounds like a long time away, but it is the end of 2023. I'm not really sure how that's happened. And it just doesn't seem like it was that long ago when we got the TCJA.
Right.
I'm not getting any younger, Pat.
Exactly.
All right. So we have received a whole bunch of notices and guidance from the Treasury Administration over the few years. I wanted to cover a few of those. Frankly, it's been a little slower than I would have anticipated with respect to regulatory guidance from the Biden administration, kind of given the position with the House being held by or controlled by the Republicans. But let's start with Notice 2023, which was related to this research and experiment or capitalization.
Right.
So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So Notice 2023-63, which has now been with us for a couple of months. I would say there was not a ton of surprising. So take a step back. Why is this notice necessary? So back when research expenditures were currently deductible, so go back pre-2022 when research expenditures were currently deductible, at least for Section 174 purposes, you didn't necessarily have to be precise in figuring out what was a Section 174 expense or not. Because if an expenditure was deductible under Section 174, okay, it's deductible. If it's not deductible under Section 174, it's almost certainly deductible under another code section like Section 162. And so did you really care that much? Now, you cared about a closely related question, which is, are these the kind of expenditures that would qualify potentially for the Section 41 research credit? Okay, but that was a separate question, and you know, and although there's a lot of overlap between those definitions, not necessarily precisely the same. However, once you have to capitalize and amortize, you need to know what you have to capitalize and amortize. And so the government, I think probably reluctantly, the Treasury Department, because of course, like everyone else, hoping that Congress would act to restore the current deductibility of Section 174 expenses and make this issue moot. Because Congress hasn't acted, taxpayers have actually had to file tax returns, right? The 22 tax return for most calendar year companies is filed. So they had to have answers to these questions. And so Treasury felt the need to come out and address some of these issues. Now, I want to emphasize, this guidance has been out with us now for over a month, but for most taxpayers, they basically put together their tax return without taking into account the guidance that's in Notice 2023-63. And the notice essentially says that's okay. So this is essentially prospective guidance for as long as this issue remains. Taxpayers can refer to the notice, but if they didn't put together their tax return based on the notice, you know, then that would be okay. So what are the kinds of issues that are addressed in the notice? So the kinds of issues that are addressed in the notice are, of course, defining what constitutes a Section 174 expense. And on that, there are issues like, well, obviously, if you have scientists working in a lab and you pay them, okay. If you have, you know, the cost of supplies in a research lab, okay, you understand that. But what happens if you have a building and part of it is devoted to research and part of it is devoted to managerial functions? And you're depreciating that building for income tax purposes. Well, how do you figure out how to split that up? So there's guidance in there around that. There are some other nuggets in there that are a little bit more interesting and I think caught some people a little bit by surprise. One relates to this question of, okay, if you have a contract research arrangement. So you agree to pay me money and I agree to perform research essentially on your behalf. I bill you for the performing of the research, you pay me. You know, the question is, of those expenditures, your expenditures to pay me and my expenditures to conduct the research, which of those expenditures are Section 174 expenditures? So, and the answer provided by the notice is, well, certainly your expenditures, you're paying me to do the research, your expenditures are Section 174 expenditures. But if I have an entitlement to utilize the results of that research, they may be Section 174 expenditures for me as well. So there's this so-called double capitalization issue that arises if you have to capitalize expenses and I have to capitalize what we might colloquially say are the same expenses, right? There's only one element of research being done. You're paying me and I'm doing research. So that was sort of an interesting thing that people are still kind of trying to wrap their heads around a little bit. Because, of course, this understanding of, well, what rights do I as the contract research provider, what rights do I have in that research? Well, it's not always as straightforward to answer, right? This is a question of what contracts, what my contract with you says, and what are the precise parameters of that? So some definitely interesting issues in there. I would say the last thing, and this was more taxpayer favorable, and there were other things in the notice as well, but the last thing, there was this question for cost-sharing arrangements. So because, of course, up until Section 174 expenses were capitalizable as opposed to immediately deductible, cost-sharing arrangements, which very frequently the costs in question in a cost-sharing arrangement are research costs. Not always, but they're quite often research costs. So the definitions for how you would split up costs in a cost-sharing arrangement and who has deductibility of costs and who has income triggered off of deductibility of expenses. So that was the language that was used in the regulations. You talked about your deductible expenses. So now you're left with this question of, well, I have this big category of expenses. They're not deductible anymore. They're costs. I'll recover them over time, but they're not immediately deductible anymore. And so the guidance in the notice essentially says, you know those costs that were formerly deductible, now capitalizable? You're going to, at least for purposes of your cost-sharing arrangement, let's act as though those are deductible and essentially use the same formulas that we've used before. So that was, I think, helpful guidance. I don't think anybody was too surprised about that, but people were a little anxious about that until the notice had come out. So a little bit of a mixed bag, but I would say probably a notice that the government, in all, you know, candor, probably didn't want to have to do, but then fundamentally felt like they had to, because we're still waiting to see if Congress will fix Section 174, essentially.
Right, and we'll keep an eye on that, report it as it happens on the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast. All right, so I want to switch gears to what I think is our who shot JR moment in international tax. And so for my, I was a child of the 80s, and I was like a kid, and my mom loved watching Dallas.
Of course, I watched it
every week. And so what I'm talking about is our this temporary foreign tax credit relief that we got in notice 2023-55.
Yes.
And boy, we could spend a lot of time talking about this, but can you just give us a little context? Because I think we recorded, I think, at least two podcasts on the proposed and the final, like, new foreign tax credit regulations came out, which was a massive shift to how we viewed about credibility. And for those that are interested in that, even though it's really no longer relevant, you can go back and listen. We're never going to get that time back. Give us a little bit of context and, like, how shocking was this notice that came out?
So the government has been on a real odyssey in the foreign tax credit area. You know, frankly, starting with the TCJA, there's been a series of regulations that have come out in the foreign tax credit area and related areas. So this would include things like expense apportionment, going back to, frankly, shortly after the TCJA was enacted. And some of that was direct result of the TCJA. But interestingly enough, what we're talking about now on the relevant topics of Notice 2023-55 really is not TCJA related, certainly not directly. But the Trump administration, right before President Trump left office, so the regulations on the proposed regulations that we're going to now be focused on, well, the starting point is the proposed regulations that came out in December of 2020. And these proposed regulations were going to introduce some new concepts, really new radical concepts, this concept of jurisdictional nexus around the creditability of a foreign tax. The government put them out in proposed form, asked for comments. They did get significant comments from the taxpayer community that essentially said, and I'm obviously paraphrasing here, don't do this. And I think the government, do I understand the direction they took? You know, I would say not really, although with respect to the comments, I think they were hoping to get some more mechanical type comments. How can we do jurisdictional nexus to make it work? Instead, what they got were comments that said, don't do this. And so they went ahead and finalized those regulations, and they changed the jurisdictional nexus requirement to what they call the attribution requirement, but essentially the same rule. They also introduced some other concepts, so restrictions on what's considered cost recovery, which is necessary for a tax to be treated as an income tax. So a lot of things that, you know, and when those final regulations came out in 2022, a lot of people in the taxpayer community were stunned, because there was just an expectation that this was, you know, tail end of the Trump administration. These regulations had come out. People weren't really focused on them, you know, terribly much. And again, people commented and said, don't do this. And the hope was that they would just put that rock back down. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the government would put it. Well, they didn't. They finalized the regulations. shortly after they finalized the regulations, they got a lot of reaction from the taxpayer community around things like, hey, you know, this cost recovery thing is a real problem. We're not going to be able, lots of countries have restrictions on the recovery of certain costs. This calls into question whether those taxes are income taxes.
And we highlighted a number of those on the Cross-Border Tax Talks podcast.
Totally. So the government first issued a technical correction to those final regulations, which was not really a technical correction. It made some relatively small language changes that were intended to provide more comfort on the issue of cost recovery. The government then went out and put out proposed regulations that would have somewhat reduced the reach of the attribution requirement. So, so-called single country rule for royalties to make it a little bit easier for taxpayers who had some more straightforward fact patterns to get comfortable that royalty withholding taxes would be creditable. So that was kind of the second thing that happened. Next, the government put out a notice earlier this year that essentially said, hey, there's some documentation requirements in this single country royalty rule. We understand people aren't going to be ready to have that documentation done. We're going to give folks more time to get that documentation done. Then we get to notice 2023-55.
Plot is thick. This is exciting.
Right. So we get to notice 2023-55, which essentially the government essentially says, we're going to rethink this whole thing. Not the entirety of that package, but the things that were causing the most pain for taxpayers. And that really was the attribution requirement and some of the cost recovery issues. Cost recovery has the proposed regulations really, the 2022 proposed regulations really did a lot to help people get comfortable on cost recovery. But the attribution requirement, in particularly for things like royalty withholding taxes and services, were a real problem. And essentially what the government says in notice 2023-55 is, we hear you. For a limited period of time, that's a key point, for a limited period of time, and that would be for calendar year taxpayers, tax years that end before the end of this year, with the end of this year. So tax years ending before January 1st, 2024. So you'll be able to essentially apply the old regulations. The old regulations meaning before the 2020 proposed regulations.
Right.
And that, as you know, Doug, those regs incorporated the so-called predominant character requirement, which was a less precise standard, but one that, frankly, over the course of the preceding decades, taxpayers had gotten very comfortable with. They understood it. The IRS could administer it. So where we are right now, if you're a calendar year taxpayer, you're essentially operating, for the most part, under the regulations that were in place prior to the release of the proposed regulations in December of 2020. Now, there's a footnote to that, which is an important one. Treasury provided in this notice, this most recent notice, that digital services taxes, which they attempted to provide a definition for, are not creditable taxes. So they made it quite clear that digital services taxes, they're not giving a pass to that while they figure out what they're going to do in this area. There's a certain irony to that, because when the 2020 proposed regulations came out from, again, at the tail end of the Trump administration, one of the comments that the Treasury Department got from taxpayers was, if you are concerned about giving credits for digital services taxes, you should write a regulation that says digital services taxes are not creditable. Instead of writing these sweeping rules that with the jurisdictional nexus requirement and everything else. And again, the government chose not to do that at the time they went final with the 2022 regulations, but they have at least now temporarily retreated to where taxpayers had wanted them to be all the way back in December of 2020, which is just give us a definition of digital services taxes and clarify that those are not creditable and essentially leave the rest of this alone. I will say, Doug, I am sure the last word has not been written on the foreign tax credit. Notice 2023-55 is not the last word on these regulations. So this is going to continue, and we're going to have to continue to watch the government's next move.
Right. And maybe their incentive to try to craft the architecture of those rules was already thinking about Pillar 2 and particularly the under-tax profit rules, but who knows?
Right.
As we look forward from an FTC perspective, we're obviously going to need guidance on this jurisdictional nexus, but what else should listeners be anticipating, and particularly a lot of questions questions. And boy, I feel like we set a record by going this long without, before I mentioned pillar two on a podcast. But a lot of questions with respect to the creditability of qualified domestic minimum top-up taxes, income inclusion rule taxes. I think we've got a year before we'll see UTPRs, at least, or maybe a couple years for at least to the U.S. But what should we be, what should listeners be anticipating with FTC?
So I think this is sort of on a relatively short fuse from the government's perspective. So the government has said publicly they're going to try to get out proposed regulations by the end of the year on the foreign tax credit. Those regulations will extend the transition relief that was provided in Notice 2023-55, which again essentially takes people back to the pre-December 2020, the predominant character regulations. That package of regulations they're expecting to issue before the end of the year will also include guidance, to your point, on the creditability of Pillar 2 taxes. Now, the government is generally signaling their intention that QDMTTs, the domestic minimum top-up taxes, that are described in Pillar 2, would be treated as creditable taxes. IIRs, income inclusion rule, and UTPR, the under-tax profit rule, those Pillar 2 taxes, the government is indicating, will not be treated as creditable taxes. Now, this is obviously all unofficial, right, but this is stuff that government officials have said publicly. So we should expect to see an extension of the transition relief, not forever. Again, the government has indicated they do not intend to sort of just retreat all the way back to the pre-December 2020 regulations, but they know they're not done figuring out what they want to do generally in that area. So they're going to extend the transition relief at the same time they provide guidance on the Pillar 2 taxes and the creditability of those Pillar 2 taxes. I honestly don't know why they think those issues have to be linked together, but that's the way they see it, and they at least for the moment, they've been pretty clear that that's their intention.
Yeah, given that Pascal Saint-Amand was on this podcast and has told, and he said this in a number of public forums, that the income inclusion rule is effectively based on our GILTI regime, it will be interesting to see whether, you know, that Treasury actually comes out and says an income inclusion rule, which is very similar to GILTI, is not creditable.
Yeah.
We will keep our eye on that.
I agree. And, you know, I mean, fundamentally, Treasury knows this. I'm obviously not speaking out of school and saying this, but they do have to start with the language of the statute. Section 901 defines a foreign income tax, or provides that Treasury is to give a credit for foreign income taxes. There's not a precise definition provided in Section 901. So essentially, what leeway does Treasury have to redefine the meaning of foreign income tax for purposes of giving a credit under Section 901? I think that's an issue they'll have to wrestle with as they think about these regs.
All right. So let's do a couple of quick hits, because there's been some other things that have been proposed or released. And the next is Notice 2223-64, which is our corporate alternative minimum tax, formerly known as the book minimum tax. Yes. I tried to get the book minimum tax to stick. I know, and we failed.
Exactly.
But the CAMT.
The CAMT.
So we've got some notice. So maybe quickly, what did that cover? And frankly, I think the bigger news is what's not covered as opposed to what's covered.
Yeah. So there were a couple of things in there that are worth noting. One is taxpayers were asking the question, there was a floor colloquy when the Inflation Reduction Act was moving through the Congress that related to the treatment of other comprehensive incomes, what people call OCI. But the government hadn't spoken on that. Treasury Department hadn't spoken on that. So in Notice 2023-64, they say, hey, just to be clear, other comprehensive income is excluded from the CAMT base. It's not considered part of your book income for purposes of the starting point for the CAMT. That's not exactly what taxpayers wanted. What taxpayers wanted is, if an OCI item is not in my regular tax, kick it out of the CAMT base. If it is in my regular tax base, include it. What else was in there? You know, honestly, Doug, there was some cats and dogs.
Yeah.
Treatment of Section 168 costs, depreciation costs. There was, I thought, a really strange provision in there that provided guidance. Now, remember, this is a notice. So this is stuff that's supposed to be the urgent stuff, right? That they need to get guidance out before proposed regulations, that dealt with if you have a financial statement restatement. Well, this is the first year the CAMT is in effect. I mean, I don't know how quickly they're expecting people to have restatements of their financials, presumably just released. But nevertheless, it's there. And so there's guidance in there on how to deal with restatements. But what's interesting about the notice is it didn't substantively address three issues that are very important, I would say, to taxpayers. And the government said, hey, this is on our radar screen, and we're going to get to it. One of those is this question about double counting, particularly of CFC distributions. So you move CFC distributions through tiers of CFCs. Is every one of those distributions treated as a taxable dividend for purposes of the CAMT? That's going to add up to a big number if you're talking about moving a lot of money through tiers of corporations. So that's one issue. A second issue, if you're on mark-to-market for book purposes but not for regular tax purposes, do you have to apply mark-to-market principles in doing your CAMT computation? This is an issue that the insurance industry went in and talked to Treasury about not long after the statute was enacted, essentially to say, if we don't get relief from this, you're going to see insurance companies essentially insolvent because of the magnitude of some of these mark-to-market swings. And so we did actually see the government address mark-to-market issues specific to the insurance industry, but they have said they're looking broadly at that. They say that in this most recent notice, 2023-64. A third big issue, treatment of partnerships. What is the meaning of distributive share? Now, we could spend an entire podcast just on those two words. But the CAMT uses the term distributive share. What does that mean for purposes in determining your adjusted financial statement income? What if you have tiers of partnerships, multiple tiers of partnerships? How do you determine the distributive share? Do you start from the bottom and work your way up? How do you define those terms and give meaning to those terms for purposes of the CAMT? That is a huge issue for certain sectors of the economy, private equity in particular, private equity and wealth management. We don't know. But we have heard from the government that that is an issue they're aware of, and they're going to provide guidance on it.
Yeah, and obviously taxpayers, particularly on the double counting issue, because to your point, that can be a really huge issue. And I think most of us believe that based on the wording currently in the statute, double counting is an issue. And so some guidance would be very, very helpful with that.
Yeah, and Treasury has a broad grant of authority to address it. And they're aware of that. I mean, Treasury officials have said publicly this is an issue they are aware of, and they're going to provide guidance that will clarify this in a way that taxpayers will find, this is my word, not theirs, but comforting. Mm-hmm. This is an issue that they want to try and take off the table. The problem is, until you actually see that guidance, you don't know what they think double counting means versus what it might mean on your facts if you're distributing, you know, potentially north of $1 billion through multiple tiers of companies. Slight differences in definition could be the difference between no tax bill and a very large tax bill, and a very unpleasant surprise and a very unpleasant conversation with a CFO. So I think, you know, for some taxpayers, for many taxpayers, what I've been hearing is they're being very cautious about this. They want to wait and see what the guidance from the government says.
Yeah, I'm anxiously awaiting myself. And maybe the last thing to mention for CAMT, particularly for our non-U.S. parented groups, again, just with Pillar 2, because this is a big trap, is that if we have non-U.S. parented groups that are invested in the U.S. that are subject to this corporate alternative minimum tax, that results in an AMT, a credit carry forward.
Yes.
That is not a good credit for Pillar 2 purposes and could cause issues to the extent that a foreign non-U.S. taxpayer ends up in CAMT in year one, and then year two is excited to get that refund because it is a temporary difference.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden there's a top-up tax owed. So something to be very mindful for non-U.S. parented groups that could be in a CAMT position.
Yes. Great point, Doug.
All right. The next one, and this one was a bit of a head scratcher, Pat, were proposed regulations to Section 367B and what is referred to as the Killer Bee regulations. And so this goes back to, I think, originally 2011 when initial regulations were proposed. And Lee Shepard wrote a series of articles. I think maybe she might get credit for the the killer, for the naming
the
of
name
the
Killer Bee.
The
I
name
don't know.
Killer
right.
Bee. I might be out of school on that one. But we've had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act where we now can, you know, get tax-free distributions back to the U.S., kind of this repatriation, Killer Bee planning, really not relevant.
Yes.
And here, you know, 5 years later, in 2023, we have proposed regulations.
Right.
I don't want to get into any of the details, but why? And what are your thoughts on that?
We've spent this podcast, a lot of this podcast up to now, talking about what's on the government's plate in terms of guidance to get out. So it is a little bit curious that the government made the decision to go ahead and put out proposed regs, basically what we call regifying some prior notices that had been issued on these triangular B, so-called killer B transactions. I mean, the speculation has been the government is proceeding to litigate on some of the cases relating to some of the transactions that were previously done. And so from their perspective, going the extra step of moving from the notices to the proposed regulations, ultimately, presumably to final regulations, was they regarded as important. But your point, I think, is the one that most people, most people's reaction to this, these proposed regulations coming out, is these transactions ceased being relevant 6 years ago, essentially.
Yeah.
And so it's strange that, we're now seeing guidance from the government on how they should be treated, because taxpayers aren't engaging in them and haven't been engaging them for years. On the other hand, taxpayers are really looking to make distributions through tiers of CFCs to repatriate money back to the U.S., and they're worried about the CAMT.
Right.
So, that would certainly, from the taxpayer community's perspective, be a much higher priority than the regulations regifying these prior 367 notices.
And I could give a few more examples, including the PTAP regulations that they've been talking about, Section 987, other things that would be of importance to taxpayers. All right, next topic, and this has nothing to do with any regs or notices, but it's the Moore case. And this is the Supreme Court case. Wade came on, I think, did an awesome job.
Right.
And we back to law school talking about, we briefed the case. But the Supreme Court has stated that they will hear oral arguments on December 5th, 2023. And Pat, I have never been this geeked up about a Supreme Court case. And there's been a whole bunch of amicus briefs that have been filed. Frankly, there's just so much out there now that I've given up trying to keep up with all of it.
Right.
But I'm interested in your thoughts on where this could be going, or any brief use.
Well, of course, there's a limit to the number of people who are actually able to appear be in the gallery when Supreme Court cases are argued. I don't know if there's a separate limit for the number of tax nerds that are allowed in, but we are in danger of broaching that limit or breaching that limit, because there's obviously a lot of excitement about this. There are literally articles every single day in the tax press. Most of it's, of course, reporting on the amicus briefs that are coming in. But there is such a level, I'd almost call it to a frenzy. I was actually very recently at an IFA conference outside the United States, and I had several people come up to me, several non-U.S. practitioners come up to me and ask me about the Moore case and what I thought the outcome was going to be, which is, of course, the most ridiculous question to ask, because, who knows? I think that as Wade talked about on the prior podcast, the potential ramifications of a sweeping decision here are, they could be quite significant to the structure of the income tax code, or there could be, frankly, a much narrower decision that has virtually no relevance to the corporate taxpayer community. We will have to wait and see. I suspect we're going to have to wait quite a while after the December oral arguments, though. If the court follows what they've done in the past, it may be May or even June timeframe before we actually see the decision. And we still face the possibility, as I think Wade also mentioned, that the Supreme Court could decide, even up to the time that the case is argued, that they had improvidently granted certiorari and just decide not to take the case. Nobody's talking about that now because I think there's so much excitement about what might happen. We will all have to watch and wait together. But it's going to be a waiting game for a while. That seems pretty clear.
It is, but it's really, fascinating to see. All right. Well, maybe for our listeners, there's a number of other things that we're going to keep an eye on. I'd mentioned the PTEP regs, the Section 987 regs, which relates to foreign exchange gain or losses for branches. Dual consolidated loss regulations are on the list. Some finalizing potential regulations on cloud computing with respect to sourcing. And then also we've heard some curious comments from Treasury that there could be some guidance related to Pillar 2. So
yes,
as we get those, Pat, I look forward to bringing you on. And these kind of going through these summaries are a lot of fun for me. So thank you very much for coming on.
No, it's great to be here, Doug, as always.
All right. So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Pat Brown, PwC's Washington National Tax Services co-leader. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services global leader. Stay tuned for another exciting edition of the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.